Next curve.
Good morning, everyone. This is Leonard Lee, Managing Director of Next Curve. Thank you for joining today's Rethink webinar on the topic of blockchain and cryptocurrencies. And for those of you who are not familiar with Next Curve, let me introduce our firm really quickly. We are a San Diego-based boutique consulting and research firm focused on providing experience-based advisory services to inspire our clients' digital future. And we advise across a wide range of digital topics, including blockchain and cryptocurrency, drawing from the expertise and experience of our executive consultants and analysts. And I started Next Curve with the goal of channeling my 23 years of experience in consulting, working with some of the leading strategy and technology advisory firms across a wide range of industry, business, technology, and strategic advisory domains, and helping my clients win and move forward with clarity into the cloudy frontier that is our digital future. And I also wanted to work with some great people like our special guest. And today, I am honored to be joined by Next Curve research partner, Lawrence Lerner. Lawrence is a highly accomplished consultant and executive advisor who has worked with some of the leading consulting firms such as PwC and Cognizant. And he is currently based in Seattle, Washington, and has been living blockchain and cryptocurrencies for the past few years, advising a number of companies through their ICOs, and is now the CEO of a fascinating blockchain venture company called Archain Holding. Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited to have the opportunity to discuss this exciting but persistently nebulous topic of blockchain and also cryptocurrency.
Good morning, Leonard. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. There's four things that we're going to focus on today. Number one, the semantics and the conceptual clarity of blockchain and cryptocurrencies. We'll then talk about the value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. We'll then talk about blockchain and the nature of blockchain. Is it a technology? Is it a solution? Is it a platform? And then we'll talk about why we think blockchain will change the world. If we have some time toward the end, we'll open the floor for questions and answers. So Lawrence, one of the things that seems very certain about blockchain and cryptocurrencies, especially Bitcoin, is that they're very confusing even to the experts. And just yesterday, I was watching an interview that featured a CEO of a financial firm on Bloomberg who called Bitcoin a currency, and then under the same breath said that it wasn't a currency. And so this is indicative of the pervasive confusion that's out there about cryptocurrencies. And when the conversation gets down to blockchain as well, it seems to be equally as confused. Lawrence, you've had hundreds of interactions with vendors and business leaders on these topics as an advisor and now the CEO of a venture company. Why do you think that there's so much confusion about blockchain and cryptocurrencies? And what do you think is the big hangup?
You know, it's an interesting question. I think to some extent, the technology and Bitcoin is a victim of its own success. When Satoshi created the first white paper and the Bitcoin infrastructure was launched, the currency, the token, and the blockchain were welded together. That's the first generation. You can't separate one from the other. So people naturally assumed that there was always this communication protocol that was the blockchain, that is Bitcoin. And while those two are fairly synonymous, when people talk about the blockchain, they mean Bitcoin's blockchain. A blockchain is a series of technologies that were unraveled from it, first by Vitalik Buterin for Ethereum. There were some others before, but Ethereum is really what made it popular. So the blockchain itself is a series of technologies and a platform that allows you to communicate, store information on ledgers which are distributed. So you sometimes hear the term distributed ledger technology as well as blockchain nodes, where you can run programs. We'll talk about that later, called smart contracts. On top of that are cryptocurrencies and then tokens, which can be transacted. So that's a lot of stuff, but really the confusion has come because people have become very enamored with the cryptocurrency token, the value, and even with the ups and downs that the market has had lately. Anyone who got in early has done really, really well.
Right. And so you mentioned the token. I think this is a really important concept. Maybe you could provide some clarity around that. You've mentioned in our discussion the importance of ERC-20, why it's critical to the blockchain and such. And maybe you can give us some explanation about what the role of the token is in the context of blockchain.
So ERC-20 tokens reside specifically on the Ethereum platform and are nothing more than short programs that allow you to transact the tokens. You can transfer them, you can receive them, you can get balance, you can share information about how many tokens are in circulation. There's some very basic things, but that's kind of the lifeblood of the system. And we can go into it in a little later in more depth, but if you don't have a token that's earnable and transactable, that's what the miners are actually doing to move things along or actually write to the blockchain. In the Bitcoin world, miners are getting paid simply to do accounting. And they write all of the that bundle up the transactions and write them to what's called a block on the blockchain.
Right. And when we look at tokens in the Bitcoin context, then it really has two primary functions. One is to serve as a mechanism for holding value, and then that incentive function that you were talking about, where it's used as a way of fueling or drawing in the participation of miners who support the overall Bitcoin infrastructure.
Is that correct? I love that term, incentive function. That is it. And that's a key point.
I think it's just something that needs to be re-examined by many folks who are in the Bitcoin conversation, because it seems like what you're saying, the focus on Bitcoin seems to have been more on the price going up and down and the recent volatility versus having a meaningful discussion around the other parts of Bitcoin, which I think are key to understanding it.
Right.
Speaking of the discourse around Bitcoin, it's been described as digital gold, digital asset, internet money. And most recently, I've heard Bitcoin being called the digital reserve currency. And there's a lot of debate out there whether Bitcoin is really a currency or not. I'm not quite convinced that it is. And I see that it functions more as a payment type and an alternative infrastructure for value transfer. And, you know, some might argue that is what a currency is. But again, going back to what I said earlier, I don't think it is. I think what you really need to do is deconstruct what Bitcoin is and start from the ground up in establishing a solid understanding of what you're dealing with. And at the end of the day, nothing is really priced in Bitcoin. The value that is assigned to it is still in terms of conventional fiat currencies. Bitcoins are translated into those traditional currencies and also subject to the exchange rate of those conventional currencies, right? And ultimately, isn't it just a payment type or method and infrastructure?
We said a lot of things there.
At its core, you know what I'm saying?
At its core, there is a stored, conceived, and perceived value of a Bitcoin, right? Bitcoins, in one way of thinking, are much like stock certificates. The Bitcoin itself is simply a transaction, and you keep hold those transactions in something called a wallet. It's completely decentralized. So unlike a currency, there's no backing by a government. Like a currency, like a fiat currency, like a dollar bill or a British pound, you can give it to someone, and once you do, the only way to get it back, you can't reverse the transaction electronically. That's the notion of non-reversible and immutable ledgers, of copying that record of saying, yes, this was actually done, are key to understanding Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. So the value that it has is based on what the market is perceiving that value against fiat currencies today. And we've seen it rise significantly. The first Bitcoin transaction was used to buy a pizza for somewhere around 10,000 Bitcoins. In today's world, that's a phenomenal sum of money because it rose. And you can look at stock certificates. The old example that people give is if you had bought Walmart when it IPO'd, right? And you know, and held on to 100 shares. After something like 20 years, it was worth $12 million. Mm. Bitcoin has followed a parallel, I won't say it's exactly the same, but a parallel path where the value has gone up because of what people perceive. They think that Walmart is a valuable commodity or stock to own. And for many reasons it is, but the same psychology goes with crypto tokens.
You know, I still think there is this confusion about what a digital asset is, because you do hear in the news, people sit there and call it digital gold, digital asset. I'll have to be honest, digital means nothing to me. When people say that, it's just vapor. When you drill down into that definition, what you find is a lot of folks really don't have a good explanation. Bitcoin is really a functional asset. There is a reason why people buy Bitcoin. So I'm not invalidating it at all. But it's not because it's a digital asset. It's because it has a function that people find valuable. The Bitcoin, the token itself, doesn't have any intrinsic value in and of itself outside of the context of its function, if you really think about it, right?
We agree and disagree with you, right? Because you said this earlier with two things. It's one, There is some perceived functional value. I agree with that.
Right.
And people hold it because they believe it will go up in price. And you keep mentioning gold. Right. Well, other people use that analogy. We don't know how much gold there is in the world. We know how much has been mined and is still in, you know, bank vaults and wherever else it's being stored. Right. We don't know how much individuals hold, but we know exactly how many Bitcoins there are. That is a mathematical concept, and there is an upper limit to the way the system was designed. So in those ways, there, you know, I think people say gold because we think of gold as a valuable thing. People who do commodities trading have a very precise and specific meaning for gold, platinum, wheat, oil, use.
Right. But I think it's exactly those types of metaphors that cause the semantic disconnect and then the conceptual disconnect. Okay, so going back to intrinsic value, gold has a value. It's a rare metal. It's not artificially rare. It's physically rare. It actually has a use outside of its perceived monetary value. So I think that's the big difference. And so if we go back to this notion of a functional asset, basically what I'm saying is that when you look at something like Bitcoin as a functional asset, we're really looking at the value of it as being sort of this aggregate spot value of the function of a Bitcoin as a unit of value. As far as the intrinsic value of Bitcoin goes, it's determined by its differentiated value as a substitute for other mediums or utilities of conventional money. So if we were to sit there and look at the other competing platforms, such as digital payment platforms like Apple Pay or Alipay, or conventional payment platforms like ACH, checks, wires, it's that differentiated value is the core value of Bitcoin in my point of view. And so if we were to sit there and say, well, what's the differentiated functional value? I think it's pretty widely known. Number one, the transactions are anonymous, right? So there's this opaqueness about the transactions. The platform is unregulated, like you said, and it's decentralized. It's not regulated by a central government or any governments for that matter. And then finally, there's this argument that it's faster and cheaper, that you can make a payment much faster than, let's say, if you made an ACH transfer of funds.
A lot of that is true. You can make the payments much faster over certain kind versus ACH, SWIFT, or international.
Right.
Bitcoin allows that hearing in about 10 minutes. The time is increasing because it's, again, a victim of its own success. There's so many transactions written on it. But it is a payment mechanism that carries the value with it because it's moving that value. But the key here is that the miners are getting paid. And today there's about 800,000 Bitcoin transactions a day that occur, and the miners get paid
right.
for that. That's where the second set of values come in. Apple Pay, I'll disagree with you, because Apple Pay removes friction from transactions. It is an accelerator in the payment method, because you have some traditional method, mostly credit cards, on the back end that it's accelerating. Bitcoin certainly reduces some of the friction, but is not completely frictionless. So there's a big
right.
between the two. At the end of the day, Bitcoin allows you to make a transaction with another entity, be it another person, be it a soda machine, or a business on a peering basis based on, you know, generally what you have on your smartphone. And it's very fast and efficient for that. And companies like Archain Cooperative that I work with are working on ways to accelerate that. And there's others like Mobius that are out there doing payment faster transactions.
Like you said, at the end of the day, Bitcoin continues to morph into something that people think that it is. There's a core concept or core function that it serves. And then there's everything else above it or is an extension of that core. Now, whether or not those extensions are valid is yet to be seen. I think some of them are sustainable. Some of them are just complete rubbish. But that is part of the definition of what Bitcoin is today. I think maybe you can agree with that.
Yes.
Lawrence, that was a great discussion. Let's move on to our next topic here, which is the value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. As of this morning, Bitcoin is priced at below $10,000 per Bitcoin, down about 50% since hitting its all-time high at around $20,000. Back in December 11th, 2017. You know, it seems that even the experts are continuing to debate the valuation and how to evaluate cryptocurrencies. Is Bitcoin overvalued? Is it undervalued? Is it priced correctly? There just seems to be no agreement, and quite frankly, very little substance behind any arguments that people put out. People just say that, I think it's going to be $500,000 by the end of the year. And when you ask the person, hey, how did you come up with that number? There's really no clear explanation. Seems like people are just pulling numbers out of the air. What do you think are the fundamentals of the value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency?
It goes
and
back
is there really a fundamental thinking around the valuation?
Of course. It's how often it gets transacted. What the U.S. government has done is look at it as a commodity. Chicago Mercantile Exchange, Chicago Board of Exchange started trading Bitcoin in December of 2017 as commodities.
Right.
It's something that has a functional value, as you said earlier, that you're able to demonstrate that people use over and over again. Bitcoin is over 600, 800,000 transactions a day. Ethereum is closing in on that. Other platforms do the same thing. Because people are using it. And just like oil or gas or orange juice, they hold value because people want them, because there's a scarcity of them, right? There's a finite number of oranges in the world at any given point. And if there's frost in Florida or California or other parts of the world, the value and the cost goes up because people want their orange juice and their scarcity of it. Bitcoin has a fixed number. It is consumable in the way that it fuels transactions, much the way you would do wheat or orange juice, where you burn oil to heat homes and power engines. There is a value there. So there's a function that says, here's why there's value. And the more that people use it, the more often you're going to see a rise. And before there was any regulation that people took seriously, the value in December came close to touching $20,000 for each Bitcoin. Then as regulation came, just like where you would have OPEC for oil, other regulations or some other outside influence, and someone says, oh, you know, this is bad, Bitcoin, we're going to lock down on it, we're going to create problems, the value goes down. So those things are always market perception, always market driven. And if you look at any of the exchanges, KuCoin, EtherDelt, Litelica, you can watch how people speculate. And there are crypto traders who are writing the same type of financial analytics. I'm not, you know, saying whether their quants are better or worse than anyone else's, but they're saying, well, you know, Bitcoin is targeting this price. My own token for our chain, the ROC, R-H-O-C, is targeting a price for this. And the analysts say this, oh, it's meeting resistance at this level, or there was a big sell-off.
Yeah.
Treated just like that. We are in a new world, though, right? This is all uncharted territory around these digital type assets.
Right.
So we're learning as we go, we're making it up. I'm personally hiring a couple of economists to work with the holdings team to figure out how this gets projected and how it's used for what we call gas pricing in Ethereum, right? The cost per transaction and the flow of the number of transactions. We call it phlogiston in the R-chain world. All of those things are really interesting topics and are generating revenue and income for people.
I wanted to talk about introducing a framework for thinking about the valuation of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Now, when we look at the current market value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, we can break down the valuation into a taxonomy that may help clarify this whole valuation conversation. And the way that I look at it, there is an intrinsic value tier, which we can call the functional value, which is further broken down into the spot value of transactional utility and the liquid and portable store of value. And what that is really the money that's sitting in your digital wallet, which is synonymous with anyone going to the bank and withdrawing cash and having cash in their wallet on hand so that they can make purchases out in the world. There's that intrinsic value set, which is comprised of these two components, right? Store of value for portability and liquidity, and then the transactional utility value. Then there is the speculative value tier, which we call the non-functional value of Bitcoin, or at least the non-functional value component of the Bitcoin spot market price, which has been driven by various hype themes and speculative transactions that support these themes. You look at subcomponents, you have the speculative trade, and then you have the speculative investments, which we're calling the speculative store of value. And these could be the monies that are in wallets of folks who have the intent of capitalizing on the appreciation of Bitcoin. The combination of the functional and non-functional spot value make up the spot market price of Bitcoin. This framework has been really helpful for me in understanding the valuation of Bitcoin. It's also helping me understand these other alternative cryptocurrencies as well. I think this is a good framework for people to use to think through what the valuation structure is for these cryptocurrencies. Based on some of the research that I've done, the portion of what we can call functional value has decreased as a proportion of the market value since 2011. You can actually see that the value of the transaction has gone from something like 30% down to like 9%.
This is a good way to unwrap the model. I like the way you've let this unfold. This is pretty good. And with the chart on the left.
And I think it really represents a lot of what we've been talking about in the debate that you and I have had on this topic.
Yep. I agree.
You've
crisped it up with some good terminology.
ICOs. You've been heavily involved with ICOs. What do you think the impact of ICOs are on the market value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies?
It's a psychology play. I mean, at the end of the day, you look at the amounts of money that are pouring into these ICOs in the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. And everybody is sitting there with these speculative thoughts going, wow, if I had gotten in early, I could have a piece of that. And that drives the price up. When they do that, you know, the ARK Blocks, which is one of the ICOs that I was loosely involved in, raised $370 million in very little time. They put a hard cap around it. Our chain did a private token sale, and we raised a significant amount of money around the sale of those assets. But in all of them, people are seeing money flowing in from all over the world. So their notion of, hey, can I get in early and do a ride like Bitcoin, where I'm buying tokens at less than a dollar, and within a few years, be able to flip them for thousands. It's very seductive and attractive for anyone who drives the price up, which has also attracted, and rightly so, regulators.
Why ICOs? Why not just crowdfund a project?
Well, in some ways, it's very much the same. The opportunity is that the structure for ICOs is a little bit looser. And again, that's what is attracting the attention of regulators. And it makes it easier to raise larger sums of money very fast because people are just transacting from one wallet to another. Whereas with traditional crowdfunding, it has a more stringent process and it's going through the credit card system or the bank transfer system, which is slower and has daily limits and caps. I helped build an equity crowdfunding company in Canada. The daily, weekly limits are capped. So this is a way to move a lot of value very quickly.
And I think that's one of the reasons why it's controversial as well, right? Especially when you factor in the whole opaqueness of the Bitcoin. Speaking of ICOs, you mentioned burnable tokens and that being an important consideration in investment. So maybe you could share your rationale there. When you look at ICOs, earnable tokens, big deal. Why?
Well, if there's no earnable token for the ICO, so when you're looking at the white paper and someone's not saying, here's how the tokens can be earned, here's how they're going to be moved around by miners to make the transaction, you got to step back and ask, so what's the value of the token if there isn't anything that transactable, right? Your transactional utility value in your very nice chart here. Yeah, I got to ask and ask the people conducting the ICO, well, what do I do with the token afterwards? And it can't internet of, hey, we're going to sell eyeballs and marketing. You know, that works for a very small number of businesses. You can't monetize that same bit of content or viewing over and over and over again. So you really need to be very careful with that if you're not seeing a way for somebody to earn to make, you know, whether it's the accounting or make the transactions going through whichever of the proofing algorithms you might be using at the time.
Great insight. Great recommendation, Lawrence. Let's move on to our next topic here, which is blockchain, the technology, not the solution. While we have titled this section blockchain, the technology, not the solution, Lawrence, you've recently suggested that blockchains are platforms, not technologies. So maybe this is another semantic and conceptual challenge that we can unravel here. What did you mean by that?
There's certainly technology involved, but in order for blockchain to be viable, there have to be off-chain activities. You have an ecosystem that you're building here that allows you to transact between not just the nodes, but the on and off-chain nodes, whatever the information is you're storing, whether it's bank records, healthcare, music purchases, whatever it might be, that ecosystem, just like AWS or Azure, that is the foundational set of components that allow you to bring in outside information, do something with it, manage it, store it, run a smart contract on, which we've talked about as being a bit of code that runs on each of the nodes and has some gas that says, all right, I'm going to do a bit of work until the gas runs out and then produce some input or output. And those are connected to the nodes via software that we call oracles. And those connect the virtual on-chain world to the off-chain world. You could be getting market data, storage information, other prices. There are many, many other things that could be done.
I think one of the things that could be clarifying for folks is maybe doing a bottoms up, right? And I think that's always been helpful for me, at least in figuring out what blockchain is, how it relates to cryptocurrencies and everything else that people talk about in this blockchain world. And where we start the conversation around blockchain is with the blockchain technologies themselves. Earlier, you referred to them fundamentally being a distributed ledger system. Cool. And you have these various instances of those that will be out there to support different kind of applications. So let's take Bitcoin. Bitcoin is also based on a blockchain, right, Lauren? And the blockchain serves as the distributed ledger, as you had mentioned prior, that supports the core accounting function of Bitcoin. And then what you have are a number of blockchain platform services. And so when you talk about the platform, it includes not only the blockchain, but also the set of services that provide some sort of interface, consensus mechanism, hashing, you know, access controls, and maybe some other functions that support a certain kind of blockchain-enabled application. What I took from what you described, Lawrence, is you're talking about all of these, but even beyond. You're talking about the ecosystem that you need to build around these platforms to deliver the target value of your blockchain-enabled solution.
Yeah. And your diagram, the levels are really interesting. I'm going to start at the top. So those blockchain and enabled applications are usually called DApps or distributed applications. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about some examples. The middle one is equally interesting. And that's my current focus for the business that I'm running. You've got interfaces, wallets, exchanges, consensus. You can't run any of this without it. The level of maturity. Right. In the industry is lumpy. There are a few places where you've got some good stuff, other places it's light. This is the, you know, I almost said the internet gold, but this is the mine that you're going to create. These are the picks and shovels. By building these, there's lots of great aspirational technologies. Don't get me wrong. I'm excited about the future of healthcare on the blockchain. Mm-hmm. That's going to take years to get right. Interfaces, wallets, and exchanges, we can do now. Mm. You don't have identity on it.
Right.
Identity, core, foundational. I'll give you a little secret. There are three identity companies I'm taking investments in right now that I see as the biggest opportunity. And within 6 months, we're going to be seeing revenue from them. One of them is a legacy software business that is refactoring to blockchain technologies because it's more effective than what they're doing. Because it's not a pivot, it's not a change in direction. They're upgrading their technology.
There's a number of platform companies out there today, right? It's IBM Bluemix. You know, we know that IBM is pretty heavy into blockchain. You mentioned Microsoft Azure, and there's Amazon with their blockchain platforms. When we have these conversations around blockchain platforms, there's already some of the big players that are doing things, but then there's, like what you're saying, a whole universe of smaller players that are doing just as impactful and compelling things in the blockchain world, right?
Lots of new entrants, absolutely. And the other opportunity is for node operators, people who are running them. As you mentioned earlier, I live in Seattle, here in Washington State. Yeah. We've got the cheapest and cleanest power in the country. So on the eastern side of Washington, we've got all of these miners with tons of capacity, and we're looking to see how they're going to pivot to becoming node operators for other technologies. It takes a lot of energy, more than it should, and the newer technologies are using much, much, much less. But boy, there is another huge investment opportunity.
So let's move on to our next topic here, which is why we think blockchain will change the world. Lawrence, you've been to countless blockchain and crypto conferences. You've hosted panels with experts. No doubt, like me, you've heard endless stories about how blockchain is this quote-unquote disruptive technology and how it'll change the world. But how will blockchain impact and change the world? And now I want to go a level deeper than just the superficial. I mean, I go to these conferences and hear people with these grand visions of how they're going to transform supply chain XYZ. They have a very difficult time getting down to the next level of detail. What do you think is that transformative force that blockchain represents?
There's a couple of things, but at the end of the day, follow the money. Where is the money flowing? And these are existing systems that you're disrupting with the manual handoffs. Government is a huge consumer of blockchain technologies. Why? Because there's a lot of manual processes, old handoffs, that can be reduced to the tune of about 30% by implementing a blockchain where the information is stored once, shared, and the individual or the corporation has the ability to control and manage who gets access to it. It's a pretty simple question. That once you do that, and anybody who's bought property in the United States will see on their purchase agreement, you know, the city recorder, the county, the state, the buyer, the seller, the banks, the mortgage company, everybody's getting their piece. Well, with the blockchain, you can reduce those as well as reducing the number of handoffs. I spoke at an insurance industry event 2 months ago. Onboarding was the thing that I brought to them, and it was a seminal moment for them where they said, oh my gosh, we would have so much less cost. And these are immediate. These are things that you can do in 6 months, not in 18 or 24, that will really change the way that the industries work. So those are some of the next level down of getting people to put that information in and storing it once and distributing it on the blockchain. Banks putting some of their attestations and information onto the blockchain to do disaster recovery. Very simple stuff that you can do today. No question about it. Other options like that exist, and those costs, they become dramatically reduced. And the cost of managing
right. reduced.
That's where your differentiation comes in.
Then if the value proposition is so great, how come the change is not following? Because when you go out there and you try to find examples of these grand blockchain implementations, quite frankly, there aren't that many out there. They're still piloting blockchain concepts.
Right. And there's lots of reasons for that. You and I have been doing enterprise level consulting for a lot of years, and we've done a lot of good work together. And the reality is these large enterprises have roadmaps of projects that they do their demand planning a year in advance, and they've got other things they can't shift to just add the blockchain projects. They're starting to think about it. 2018, 2019, I will bet you a shiny Bitcoin or any other currency you want, you will see them on their roadmaps, number one. Number two, there's not more than a handful, and by that I mean maybe 5,000 blockchain developers in the world, people who are dedicated to building on blockchain, who understand blockchain architectures, not just saying, oh, I can write a smart contract or I can stand up a node. And we saw this in the internet days as well. Oh yeah, you know, I was able to get a website. Well, but a web architecture is very different, is a very different type of distributed architecture. So being able to have those skills, those are some of the barriers. And again, that's what I'm looking to help people do, is create the content, invest in e-learning, get other companies out there so that we can manufacture more engineers who know how to architect and deliver blockchain-centric solutions, which is very different than what we've been doing. Those are some of the barriers. They're low barriers. Towards the end of 2018, you'll see more people doing this. 2019, you'll see certificate programs in code academies and in universities doing this. I'm sponsoring a couple through my company. So you'll see more. It's going to accelerate.
We've been at this point before. I was in Hong Kong for a better part of a year working with a logistics transport company that was trying to implement a global logistics and transportation services hub, doing something very similar, actually almost exactly what folks are trying to do with blockchain today in terms of disintermediating the middlemen in the transportation industry. At the end of the day, it wasn't technology that was the problem or the answer. It was really the challenge of disintermediating the 3PLs and the freight forwarders. It's easy to sit there and say, oh, hey, we have this great technology and it's going to disrupt everything. But you know what? The reality is, how are you going to take somebody out? How are you going to take those middlemen out? And I don't think that that's as easy as people think, because you know what? We came up with a great solution. Functionally, in terms of value proposition, had exactly the same values that are being proposed today. So this is where I think the change strategy as well as governance are very, very important. Lawrence, you and I, we lived through the dot-com era. We were there, right? We've seen this before. Yes, there will be change. But the thing is the lessons I learned from the first dot-com era was you have to temper your expectations and get real. We still have yet to have that conversation around a lot of these blockchain topics.
No doubt. And they're, you know, don't get me wrong. It's not all about the technology. There's some real process change and a change in thinking.
Great.
And the mindset of blockchain developers and innovators and entrepreneurs is really about decentralization and spreading out the opportunities for more people. And that's going to take time as well. And you know, that's what's evolving. The way that we think about having to do this and how we govern these platforms. It's why I'm getting the economists involved. It's why my own company is doing a 4-day conference on governance here in Seattle. I mean, these are key topics and we're opening it to a broad audience.
Well, I'll have to attend. That sounds great. It is going to take time. I think the aspirations are great. They're going to drive people to engage in the blockchain conversation. But the key point I think I'm getting from this segment of our conversation is that things are going to get more complex. Yeah. In fact, the more I think about it, what you want are experienced people who've been there and done that, have lived through the cycle, but also know process, know technology, know how change works. It's not good enough to have aspiration or vision. The filter for what's going to be real and practical and sustainable is going to be that experience filter, I think. And I think that's going to be increasingly valuable because, you know, we don't need to make the mistakes that we made during the dot-com era, with people throwing billions and billions of dollars into junk companies and ideas. You don't have to make those mistakes, but, you know, we do anyway.
Fundamentals, and hopefully people reach out to folks who've lived through it and don't want to repeat any of those lessons. That's why I've put together this company, because we've got a lot of experienced people who made those mistakes, right? I mean, you know, you've never made a mistake, you've never accomplished anything.
Exactly. That's great, Lawrence. That does it for the core of our discussion. So implications for our business leaders coming out of our discussion. Number one, given the state of where Bitcoin is today, you really need to consider that it may not be money in arriving at some clarity in what Bitcoin is.
Right.
As we mentioned before, Bitcoin continues to morph in definition, but the best thing for all of us to do is really work our way backwards and identify what the core function and value of Bitcoin is, and then work out from there, right? And then I think that's very helpful in at least having a baseline understanding of Bitcoin.
I think that sums it up really well.
Cryptocurrencies are risky given pervasive, persistent confusion. I think this ties with the first one. Again, getting some semantic and conceptual clarity on cryptocurrencies, in particular Bitcoin, is going to help you make better judgments about the risk associated with it. The confusion is going to persist, I think, because most people aren't going to go through the exercise that we just went through today.
Right.
Lawrence, you want to take this one?
Just if you're going to invest, there's a lot of good opportunities out there. There's also a lot of bad actors. Read the white paper, understand who the team is, what's their background, have they worked together for a long time, is that token earnable, how is it being used, because you've just paid some money for it. The thing that's going to cause it to go up in value is not because other people are putting money in, it's because it can be moved around and used and consumed in transactions. Also, you know, is there a finite number of them? There is cases like Dogecoin where it's a novelty, you know, it was done as almost a parody and the value has gone up, but there's no upper limit to the number that can be created. So you really need to watch out for those things. Never invest more than you can afford to lose, please.
Sage advice from Lawrence. Thank you. Blockchain is a tool. The governance model is the key to change. I don't think we can emphasize this enough. As you start to bump into these folks claiming that they're going to change the world, make sure that you really understand the implications of change in governance, because none of these large transformations happen easily, and it's never technology that drives it. Technology can enable it, but the hard work happens when you have to start to sell the solution and especially if you're trying to disrupt a particular industry or status quo, not as easy as people imagine it to be.
Exactly.
And finally, the internet of blockchain is coming. New possibilities and new confusion. And what we're trying to say here is, look, blockchain itself is evolving. You have folks like Lawrence who are investing in these companies that are really pushing the edge of blockchain technologies as well as cryptocurrencies. And all these things are going to continue to morph going forward and advance. And they create new possibilities, but what's also certain is they are going to create new confusions. It's going to be a challenging future around blockchain, and having foundational clarity is going to be very important. And just like folks didn't really understand what cloud was or what internet was back when they were first introduced, we're facing the same sort of situation here with blockchain and the cryptocurrency.
Absolutely. Blockchain ecosystems are going to radically transform, even for the simple things that we're doing around identity this year, are going to be very deep thought processes with things like verifiable claims and zero knowledge proofs, where you're only sharing that one bit of information that's required to pass a transaction. Simplest example is you walk into a bar, right? Blockchain walks into a bar, and everybody, you assume or know that everyone's over 21 because there had to have been some gating process where that was done. But in that case, with a verifiable claim, all you need to know is the individual is over 21. You don't need to know sex. You don't need to know where they were born or their exact age. All you care about is that they're over 21, and that's it.
Right, right. Okay. Well, thanks, Lawrence. So let's move on to our Q&A section really quick here. I think we have time for about one question. Lawrence, it looks like you have a question here. What do you think about the news from Facebook not allowing the promotion of ICO and cryptocurrency related ads and messaging?
Well, it goes back to everything we've talked about. I applaud them for doing it. There's a lot of bad actors out there, and it's really hard to tell, especially when someone comes and says, here's an ad. You need to do a lot of due diligence on that ad to make sure that it's valid, and it's pretty tough.
Right.
So good for Facebook for stepping up and saying, you know, we're not going to take an extra dollar or whatever the number is to do these where people could potentially be scammed until we figure out a good process. I've got some answers to that around identity solutions and would love to talk to the folks at Facebook, and I'll be reaching out to them.
Lawrence, I really want to thank you for your participation here and your contributions to this piece. And we really look forward to having you in future conversations, future collaborations. Thank you so much for that.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. If you'd like to find out more about the Next Curve points of view on this and other digital topics of the day, go to our website, www.next-curve.com. You will find research notes, media, and replays of this and other webinars on our site. You can also follow us a number of ways. One is on our website, as I mentioned. You can subscribe and get notified when we publish and post new insights and research. And we'll also be launching a subscription-based channel with exclusive content for our executive members. We are also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and friend us on Twitter to get live feeds and coverage of industry conferences that we attend and special Next Curve events. We have a number of exciting topics that we will cover through 2018 as part of our series on blockchain and cryptocurrencies. Here are some of the topics we have in store for the first half of the year. Our first session will be My ICO Journey. Several of our principals have experience taking companies through their ICO, and they'll be sharing their experiences with you. Designing a blockchain solution for your business, your industry. We also have principals who have worked with large enterprises in implementing production blockchain solutions. They'll share their insights with you on what it takes to actually deliver a real blockchain solution. The future of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin. We'll have a panel discussion here with a number of cryptocurrency experts to talk about where we think cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin will go in the future, near and far. We hear a lot about this convergence at IoT conferences, as well as blockchain conferences. And we're seeing this convergence of dialogue, but also thinking around solutions and how a combination of blockchain and IoT can create new possibilities for business. Another convergence topic is that of AI and blockchain. This is another discussion that is emerging and becoming quite popular. We will have an expert panel discussing what this means for your company in terms of possibilities and opportunities. If you are interested in talking to NextCurve about how we can help you and your organization gain clarity on the opportunities and risks presented by blockchain and cryptocurrencies, please contact us. We offer a range of advisory services to help your team baseline a clear understanding of digital topics such as blockchain and cryptocurrencies and advise you on your journey to opportunity and value. We are offering executive workshops and inquiries, which are great ways to get NextCurve involved in your blockchain and cryptocurrency aspirations and initiatives. We also have a number of engagement options that can fit the needs of your organization, from custom research projects, executive workshops, to expert panels and inquiry. Contact Leonard Lee by email or telephone for a scoping discussion to figure out how NextCurve can be part of your next step with blockchain and cryptocurrencies.
Visit us at www.next-curve.com.